I just wanted to begin, of course, by thanking Andy and Michelle for both the opportunity to speak in memory of their respective mothers, who we'll talk about interspersed with the subject matter this evening, and also for bringing together such a wonderful and diverse coalition. I know that there are family members here that go back many, many decades, as was just mentioned, with the women that we'll remember tonight who share the same yahrzeit, and not just the fact that their son and daughter respectively married one another. And beyond the family, of course, the extended community from the Jewish Center and friends from Beth Aaron and the broader Teaneck community. So it really is a very special opportunity, not only to wish each other a Shavua Tov, but to do a little bit of learning in memory of two very special women, and to also think deeply about this time of year in which we find ourselves, and then more broadly, some of the challenges that we're experiencing right now in terms of the pandemic in the context of this particular time of year. So allow me to begin with the notion that the concept of a yahrzeit, in the case of Andy and Michelle's mothers, marked on the 2nd of Iyar, is itself a kind of a microcosm of our topic tonight. That is to say, the very idea of taking time, a special day of the year, to reflect on those who are no longer with us, is actually a great testament to the kind of history orientation of Judaism per se. That is, to put it very simply, we are a people that cares an enormous amount about the past. You might think that this is obvious, and from people who were reared within our faith tradition, there's perhaps nothing as intuitive as the significance of memory and of commemorating the past, but it should be noted that many other faith traditions actually spend a lot more time and energy contemplating the future. And we should begin our lecture this evening by taking a moment to reflect on how it's actually not intuitive. It's not obvious, and it's not the case in every faith tradition, that there is this kind of overwhelming preoccupation with the past. Now, of course, Judaism certainly makes very clear assertions about the future and about redemption, but it is striking as a point of departure to note that not one of the 613 mitzvot relates to any particular belief about the future. To be sure, Maimonides, Rambam codified certain doctrines regarding the future, including the Messianic era, revival of the dead, ingathering of the exiles, so on and so forth. But, of course, Judaism is first and foremost normative. We look towards our halachic or legal system, if you prefer, and we have not a single normative obligation that concerns the future. As Maimonides puts it in his own inimitable language, what is incumbent upon us is to believe in those matters that I just articulated and not to spend too much time contemplating future events. In fact, the Talmud states that those who try to pin down when exactly the Messianic era is to begin, the Talmud condemns them in the strongest possible language. Judaism abhorred messianism throughout all of the ages. In stark and striking contrast to all of that, we find a normative preoccupation with the past. We're obliged to remember, of course, the exodus from Egypt. We're obliged to remember the attack of Amalek. We're obliged to remember Zachor et Yom HaShabbat, the Kodesho. According to Nachmanides, the playing field is expanded considerably. There's a Torah-level obligation to remember Revelation itself at Mount Sinai. There's a Torah-level obligation to remember, we're just coming off the Torah portions that we would have read in synagogue this week, surround the persona of the Mitzora, the individual afflicted with Tzaraat. Nachmanides considered it normative to remember the specific historical episode surrounding Miriam. We have many, many normative obligations that surround the past, and not a single one of the 613 commandments that is normative with respect to the future. Again, that doesn't mean that we don't have assertions about the future. It doesn't mean that we're disinterested in the future, but the contrast is very profound, and it's highlighted by consideration of Judaism relative to other faith traditions where one doesn't find the same degree of normative association with the past and much more of an emphasis placed on eschatological matters, on matters of that particular faith tradition's view of what the future would look like. I'd like to try to understand what perhaps the meaning of this discrepancy is. I should note, before we try to peel back that layer, that it's not merely the normative obligations, which I just briefly considered, again, Amalek, Shabbos, Exodus from Egypt, Revelation itself, the historical events surrounding Miriam, and the truth is that there are more, but one finds a kind of overarching meta-emphasis on this point, that is to say, consideration and appreciation of the past, in two very critical passages in Tanakh. One of them is towards the end of the Chumash itself, in the 32nd chapter of Sefer Devarim, in the Song of Ha'azinu, we're told the following: Zechor Yemos Olam, Binu Shenos Dor Vador, She'al Avicha V'Yagedcha, Zekenecha V'Yom Rulach. We are to remember the days of the world, we are to binu, we are to understand, develop a sense of historical appreciation, Shenos Dor Vador, each and every generation, what I would call the arc of history, historical trajectory. Sha'al avicha v'yagedcha, we should ask our parents, and they will tell us, and if we are so fortunate, zikenecha v'yom rulach, to ask even the generation before that. That is to say, history, for us, is a way of developing a Weltanschauung, a way of developing a worldview. And in parallel to this, the very last words of prophecy that the Jewish people were given, this is now the last pasuk in all of Nevi'im, in the Navi Malachi, which is the last of the 12 books of Trei Asar, we're told, Zichru Toras Moshe Avdi, Asher Tivisi Oso Bechorev Al Kol Yisrael, Chukim U'Mishpatim. Remember the Torah of Moshe, my servant, who commanded all of Israel at Sinai, the laws and the ordinances. Again, another overarching meta pasuk, which reflects the importance of memory of the Torah, with an eye towards the centuries and millennia to come, and the fidelity to those institutions of Torah that would be required throughout all of the ages. So it's undeniable that we have this profound emphasis on the past. Now, what exactly is the meaning of all of this? So I'd like to suggest a little bit of a counterintuitive premise that it has absolutely nothing to do with disregard for the future. Indeed, I think it does bespeak a skepticism, a very cautionary note with respect to messianism about making any kind of definitive, very particular predictions that, like I said, the rabbinic tradition in particular abhorred, Tipeach Ruchan Shal Mechash V'Kitzin, a famous line from the Gemara in Sanhedrin. But the basic premise that I'd like to develop is the notion that it wasn't Judaism's disinterest in the future that led us to focus, normatively speaking, far more on the past, but it was in fact the opposite notion entirely. That we understood, Judaism understood, that the only true and tested roadmap towards a proper future, towards the optimal and ideal future, was by understanding and internalizing the lessons of the past. As we like to say, Chadesh Yameinu Kekedem. What we seek in redemptive terms is a kind of a restoration Kekedem. We cannot possibly, Judaism postulates and insists, we cannot possibly develop a proper orientation towards the future without a proper and thoroughgoing perspective and even understanding of the lessons of the past, of the lessons of Jewish history. Now, this is true, in my estimation, of course, all year long. Everything that I've cited up until now, both in terms of normative evidence and overarching evidence, the kind of pasuk of Zechor Yemos Olam Binu Shnos Dor Vador, or Zichru Toras Moshe Avdi, not mitzvos in particular, but certainly overarching obligations to develop a sensitivity towards memory of both the past and our spiritual commitments in addition to that. I think it's true all year long, but it's especially true this time of year, beginning with Pesach and culminating in the nights that we'll have this week, Yom HaZikaron, Yom HaAtzmaut. Of course, the essence of Pesach, in terms of a holiday, is not merely remembering the Exodus. Of course, there is a daily mitzvah of Zechiras Yitzias Mitzrayim. The Torah speaks about this in multiple places, including in Sefer Dvarim. Leman Tizkoras Yom Tzeischa Meretz Mitzrayim Kol Yimei Chayecha. We understand, based on the Mishnah and Brachos, that this means both day and night, that we're obligated to remember the Exodus. But the apotheosis of this notion of remembrance of the Exodus is, in fact, transporting oneself in time. As we say, in every generation, each person is obligated to conceptualize themselves as if he or she, in particular, left Egypt. B'chol dor v'dor chayav adam liros es atzmo ki'ilu hu yatza mimitzrayim. Memory is no longer the issue. We've transcended memory, but we're actually called upon to consider ourselves as if we were the ones who left Egypt. That, of course, puts us in more than just a historical framework, but actually challenges us to go beyond that. And then Pesach, of course, rolls right over into Yom HaShoah, which we'll talk about, and then, of course, Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaAtzmaut. So we're remembering both ancient and, historically speaking, very recent events, in particular at this time. And so I thought the best way of approaching this Yahrzeit lecture would be through the prism of history and my premise, which I just shared a moment ago, that it's not so much a preoccupation with the past for the past's sake, but that we believe that there are certain lessons to be gleaned from history that will position us properly towards the optimal and ideal future. Let's begin, of course, with Yom HaShoah. Yom HaShoah, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, whose Yahrzeit it was today, my revered teacher, wrote in a brief but seminal essay called I Am With Him in Distress, Responding to the Holocaust, that Holocaust memory should really focus on two perspectives. If you look at rabbinic literature, Rav Lichtenstein noted, the destruction of the temple was codified into Jewish law in two very different ways. We have what we call Zecher L'Churban. We remember the destruction itself. That's to be sure. The Gemara in Bava Basra details many things that we do. We were just talking, some of us before we started the lecture, about Andy and Michelle's wedding. So, of course, this is familiar to us from the wedding practices that we have, breaking the glass, putting ashes on the forehead in the place of the tefillin, just above the forehead of the bridegroom. These are standard practices that we have, Zecher L'Churban, amidst the broader constellation of such practices. This is observed by leaving a space in the home unpainted. This is observed, of course, by tearing, which is practiced by some upon seeing the Temple Mount or the city of Jerusalem, in particular historical eras. The point is, there's a whole body of legislation which is Zecher L'Churban. And certainly part of Yom HaShoah is to remember the scale and singular nature of the destruction of European Jewry. Of course, this is something that bears particular relevance to both Andy's mother, who was a refugee, we'll discuss a little bit more of her story later, from Germany, was able to escape, thank God, to this country, and Michelle's mother, Sarah Esther Bat Shmuel, who actually lived through the inferno and saw the hell on earth called Auschwitz her very self, and thank God, and God's kindness, was able to survive, and of course, we're here remembering her tonight. So a big part of it is Zecher L'Chorban, but that's not the totality of what Yom HaShoah must be. There's another dimension, as noted by Rav Lichtenstein, which is what we call Zecher L'Mikdash. Rabbinic legislation wasn't only about remembering the destruction, but just as importantly, and in my view, some ways even more importantly, remembering the glory that was. So for example, we have the institution of carrying the lulav all 7 days, like they did only in the Mikdash. You remember the Pasuk in Parshas Emor details the mitzvah of Arba Minim, of lulav and esrog, which was normative for one day, ulakachtem lachem bayom harishon, outside of the Mikdash, but within the temple itself, was normative for all 7 days. Our practice to take the lulav all 7 days, excluding Shabbos, of course, for other reasons, is a form of zecher l'mikdash. And the analog, in terms of Holocaust memory, is to remember the glorious culture that was developed by Eastern European Jewry. And I think that if you look at the history of Holocaust scholarship itself, this has been the overall trajectory that we've seen. In the initial years, there was a kind of a sense of embarrassment, especially felt in Israel, for many reasons that are beyond our scope tonight, regarding the destruction that surrounded the Holocaust. And people were concerned with issues like sheep to the slaughter, etc. Thankfully, really thankfully, we've matured and moved beyond such oversimplistic and I would say crude notions of what it was that transpired, and we've developed a much broader sensitivity towards different forms of heroism that were displayed during the Holocaust, all of which bespoke the glorious culture of European Jewry. And if I had to distill it, though of course there are many aspects of this culture, what I would suggest is that Eastern European Jewry, under the most adverse of circumstances, which again included unfathomable levels of anti-Semitism, of violence, which culminated in the Shoah, but certainly did not begin with the Shoah, that European Jewish culture was able to develop an unsurpassed level of commitment to scholarship and erudition. Now, of course, in Eastern European countries, where there was less access that Jews had towards general culture, so this was applied almost exclusively in the realm of Torah study, which is all very well documented. In Central and Western Europe, more enlightened cultures generally speaking, this had the opportunity not only to express itself in terms of Torah scholarship, but equally expressed itself when Jews were allowed to in remarkable achievements in a very limited amount of time in the sciences and literature, as is known to all of you. So part of the Yom HaShoah memory, it's not just the Zecher L'Chorban, but Zecher L'Mikdash, is a celebration of the culture of scholarship and erudition, which we can all be so very proud of, and which Jews fought to maintain, even under the conditions of Shoah themselves. I think by this point, we're all familiar with stories of Chadarim that continued to exist in ghettos. One of the most famous works which is studied in the context of the Shoah is a work called Shelos U'Tshuvos Mimamakim, which were questions and responsa that were composed by Rav Ephraim Oshri, who was then a very young Rav in the Kovno ghetto. It's a remarkable history, and it is a remarkable literature. Moreover, Eastern European Jewry did not only concern itself with scholarship, and here we certainly have an emphasis on Michelle's mother, but a culture and a society that was predicated on chesed. Not for nothing did Chazal tell us, the Gemara in Yevamos, that there are three indelible features of Klal Yisrael. Rachmanim, Baishanim, and Gomlei Chasadim. People who were modest, and people who were compassionate, and people who engaged in loving kindness. The family that Michelle comes from, the Vague family, was renowned in Carpathia and Salatvina for the chesed that they practiced, the tzedakah that they gave. And this was true even amongst people and even in communities where there was a much higher level of poverty. Even the communities that lived in the highest degree of indigence and poverty all had chesed societies, all did their best to take care of one another. Rambam's celebrated statement, obviously going back to 12th century Sfarad, that he never saw a Jewish community that did not have a kupat tzedakah, that did not have a proper tzedakah fund and chesed organizations. So this, of course, maintained throughout the centuries and is a major part of Zeicher LeMikdash. It's a reflection that we all engage in this time of year in remembering the glorious culture of kindness that was manifest by European Jewry. The antithesis, of course, was the cruelty and barbarism displayed by the Nazis and their accomplices throughout all of Europe. But even under those conditions, individuals, as we all know, continued to engage in profound acts of chesed, of kindness for one another, even as they themselves were suffering so terribly. So again, in remembering the Shoah, we're not just remembering the destruction, but we're remembering a living culture, a culture of scholarship, and a culture of chesed, a culture of kindness. And if my premise this evening is correct, then in remembering that with respect to Yom HaShoah, and again, the microcosm of it would be what I just mentioned in conjunction with Michelle's mother, we then recommit ourselves to those values. I'd like to add one piece, which was also noted by Rav Lichtenstein in the aforementioned essay. Towards the culmination of that essay, and if anybody wants it, please feel free to contact me. I'm happy to disseminate it, especially in conjunction with his Yahrzeit. He notes that our work in this generation, and I would say this will continue for some time, is, of course, to pick up the baton that, quote, was cruelly struck from their hands. We may not think of it in these terms exactly, but the truth of the matter is that if you would ask anyone of us, you know, how we thought about a Jew who lived in the year 150 CE, our first association would likely be that this person was living just 80 years after the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash, of the second Commonwealth, and we would probably evaluate their contributions along those lines. That is to say, what did they do to help reconstitute Jewish life after such a massive catastrophe and calamity? This time of year, of course, during the Omer, we remember Rabbi Akiva, whose life story is inextricably linked with his reconstituting the Jewish people, and you could say the same thing about his great-grand-rabbi, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who started this work, but Rabbi Akiva surely continued it, in terms of helping the Jewish people get their footing back in the wake of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash itself. Now, Rabbi Akiva is also a cautionary note of what I spoke about before, the dangers of messianism and his involvement with Bar Kokhba, but that, of course, is just a very small part of his overall sterling and remarkable legacy that we remember, again, this time of year, his ability to reconstitute a Torah community that had been shattered in the wake of the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash. And again, I should note that in that respect, he was very much continuing the work. His two primary Rebbeim were Rabbi Lazar and Rabbi Yeshua, who were students of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who deserves a lion's share of credit for shepherding the Jewish people through the actual destruction itself. And so the same very much applies to us today. If Rabbi Akiva lived roughly 80 years following the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash, that is exactly the historical time period in which we find ourselves. And so every act of Jewish consciousness and Jewish communal work that we engage in, whether again it's Torah study, as we're doing right now, or communal prayer, or communal chesed, or advancing the broader interests of the Jewish people, is not just significant minei uvei, per se, intrinsically, it surely is, but it takes on a second dimension. It's all part of the reconstitution of the Jewish people who suffered such a catastrophe. And that is the way that I would suggest we should all think of ourselves, and we'll continue with a very specific manifestation of that in just a few moments with respect to Yom HaAtzmaut. Moving from Yom HaShoah for just a moment to Yom HaZikaron, I think proper reflection on Yom HaZikaron puts us in touch with other prized and cherished Jewish values. And I would say, essentially, they are twofold. Yom HaZikaron is, of course, a day which is set aside on the calendar to reflect on those who gave their lives in service to the Jewish people and the land of Israel, who brought about the reestablishment of the State of Israel, which was so meaningful to Michelle's mother and to Andy's mother in a different sense as well. Yom HaZikaron, as such, is really about two values. Gratitude, number one, and Mesiras Nefesh, sacrifice, number two. The Jewish people have always put a premium on gratitude. The first word that a Jew says every single day is Modeh or Moda Ani, right? That we give gratitude to God for the opportunity to have another day. It would be inconceivable and totally unacceptable for us as a people to celebrate the state of Israel without first reflecting on those who made that state possible. What's referred to in Israeli culture, quoting the very celebrated poem, as the Magash HaKesef, the silver platter upon which the state was delivered. And it wasn't a silver platter, but it was, of course, nearly 25,000 lives that were laid down for the sake of the rebirth of a Jewish state and Jewish sovereignty in Eretz Ha'avot, in our ancestral homeland. So by reflecting, you know, on the past, it puts us in touch with a core and cardinal value, of course, the value of Hakarat HaTov, the value of gratitude. But as I said a moment ago, it doesn't end there. But the other chief focus on Yom HaZikaron is the idea of Mesiras Nefesh, a time-honored Jewish value where Jewish people always understood themselves in broader terms. They didn't only live for themselves. Obviously, Judaism allows for personal creativity and for a degree of encouragement of people to fulfill their own life streams. Many of us studied the second chapter of Pirkei Avos, as is the custom. This Shabbos afternoon, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi both sort of posed the rhetorical question within that chapter about what the proper path in life is. So Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi answered the question by saying, "Kol shehi tiferes la'oseha v'siferes lo min ha'adam," that the proper path in life takes into account what society needs, but also is tiferes la'oseha, reflects the predilections and specific qualities of the individual involved. So Judaism certainly honors that aspect, but in an overwhelming kind of a way, requires us to understand ourselves not as free agents, not as people who live only to achieve whatever it is we can for ourselves, but as the other Mishnah Avo says in the second chapter, in the name of the great Hillel, who is the rabbi of pretty much every that I spoke about today, including Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Hillel said, "Al tifrosh min hatzibur," the overall and overwhelming communitarian orientation that Yahadus has. And of course, the highest expression of this is when people are prepared to sacrifice their lives on behalf of the Jewish people, and each and every one that we remember on Yom HaZikaron can be considered such a person who knowingly laid down their life so that the Jewish people might live, so that a Jewish state that reflected Jewish values might be reborn. So again, to summarize and distill so far, what we've tried to lay out as idea is that conceptualization of the past helps us refine and distill values that will best position us for the future. So Yom HaShoah, again, if we focus not only on Zecher LeChorban, but Zecher LeMikdash, puts us back in touch with Talmud Torah, a culture of scholarship, and Chesed, a culture of kindness. Yom HaZikaron puts us in touch with other cherished values like self-sacrifice and gratitude. And of course, that brings us to Yom HaAtzma'ut, the celebration of the restoration of Jewish sovereignty itself. And I think when we contemplate Yom HaAtzma'ut, what we're really contemplating is not so much just the miracle of statehood, probably best articulated by Rabbi Soloveitchik, and still the most important work of religious Zionism, to my mind, they've written Kol Dodi Dofeik, the Six Knocks, all of the different providential aspects that had to come together for the state to be reborn. We all know the history, the United Nations, the partition plan, the refusal of our erstwhile neighbors to accept that, which led to the war, and of course, indeed, the Jewish victory in the war at enormous cost, 1% of the population, speaking of Mesiras Nefesh. But to me, the most amazing thing about Yom HaAtzma'ut is that the Jewish people, through two millennia of diaspora, continue to yearn for Jewish sovereignty. That is the greatest story of all. The fact that there was even an interest in restoration of Jewish sovereignty. Now, not every Jew did yearn for that. Of course, Zionism was a very controversial issue. And again, I'm not just talking about rejectionism of Zionism on religious grounds, as is still the case within the Satmar community, neighbors of Michelle's family in Carpathia, but not the approach that her family took, where there's a tradition that any kind of political activism is illicit based on a Talmudic passage in Ksuvos, which describes Shelo Yalu Vachoma. That's one form of rejectionism. But there was also a concern that came from the other end of the religious spectrum about what this meant in terms of dual loyalties, questions that were raised going back as far as the 18th century in Germany, and certainly were articulated very forcefully in the 20th century in the United States of America as well. But the vast majority of the body of the Jewish people continued to yearn for a return to Zion. And I consider that to be, I'm just going to mute everybody once more, just it makes it easier than anybody who wants to, will certainly leave time for questions. So the remarkable thing was that Jews continued to yearn to be able to return to their homeland. That itself should not be taken for granted, that we didn't simply fold up our tent and say, okay, so, you know, it's been quite a while, it's been centuries, it's been millennia. Our goal should be assimilation, you know, into the general population. That was not the approach. Jews continued to pray and to yearn for a return to Zion itself. And I think, in that sense, maybe the deepest reflection of all on Yom HaAtzmaut is the Jewish capacity for hope and for renewal, a certain indefatigable optimism that our people have always manifested. We like to call Andy's mother by the name Ma'ayan. And last year, in conjunction with the Shiva, the opportunity to share the following reflection that I think is apropos our remarks concerning Yom HaAtzmaut this evening. And they, again, can be traced both to the Parsha that we would have read today in Shul, as well as to the chapter of Pirkei Avos that many of us had the opportunity to look at this afternoon. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, as was mentioned just a moment ago, asked his students what the proper path in life was. And then the chapter details how Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had five illustrious students. And the two that were surpassed even the other three within that rarefied group were Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, who again was the Rebbe of Rabbi Akiva, was mentioned, who had a kind of a steel trap memory. He's considered a bor sud, she'enu ma'abe tipa. He never forgot anything that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai taught. And then there was a lesser known figure by the name of Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach was considered by Abba Shaul to be the equal of all of the other scholars of his generation. Who was this man? So the Gemara in Masech Shabbos tells his story. The Gemara says that he was a surpassing and creative scholar, and then he sort of got derailed in life and got somehow caught up in hedonism, and he returned to the community of scholars after this period of spiritual estrangement in his life, and was called to read the Torah from the 12th chapter of the Book of Exodus, the famous verse, HaChodesh HaZelachem, and he even lost the ability to simply read the language, and he read it as HaChereish HaYalibam, that their hearts literally went deaf. This is obviously a metaphorical Gemara, but it says all the other scholars prayed for him, and his learning was restored, and from that moment on, he was extremely careful not to take anything for granted. And about him, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, and here Andy's mother's name is relevant, that he was kima'ayan hamisgaber, that he was like a ma'ayan, that he was a dynamic, flowing, powerful body of water. So whereas Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus was compared to a mikvah, which is a source of purity, the bor sud she'enu ma'abe tipa. Let's remember, a mikvah is just a gathering place for rainwater, effectively. We have very fancy mikvahs today with cleaning systems and filtration, but the essence is, as the Torah says, a bor mikvah mayim. But the other way to achieve purity, and it's highlighted twice in the parashios that we would have read today, both in terms of purification of the mitzorah, and it's also sine qua non for the purification of the zav, somebody who's experiencing a bodily flow, is a ma'ayan. For that, you can't use a mikvah, but you need what's called mayim chayim. You need dynamism. You need a body of water that constantly renews itself. And Yom HaAtzma'ut, above just the political and military and economic, you know, miracle, which is all true and all valuable, to me, the greatest lesson that it teaches us is that Jews continue to yearn for this. If something disappeared today, could we really expect that thousands of years from now, there would be people who would like to see it brought back? The will to renew ourselves is itself the greatest miracle of Yom HaAtzmaut. There is no analog in terms of human history, if we have a proper understanding. And so Yom HaAtzmaut itself puts us in touch with a remarkable value, a cherished value of our people, the idea of constant hope and constant renewal. The pasuk that I just cited, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem, is the first mitzvah that's given to the Jewish people. In fact, Rashi, the very first Rashi in the Torah, wonders in the name of Rabbi Yitzchak, why did the Torah not begin with the pasuk of HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem? It should have really started with Kiddush HaChodesh, with sanctification of the new month. And there's an answer that's given there, which is very fascinating, is that if we didn't have all of the book of Genesis, we wouldn't know that the land of Israel is promised the Jewish people. That's an appropriate Rashi to cite in the context of Yom HaAtzma'ut. But it's the question itself, which I think is all the more fascinating. Really, the Torah should have started with the relationship between the Jewish people and the moon. Because as the Midrash says, Nimshala Yisrael Lalavana, the Jewish people are like the moon. We wax and we wane and then we wax again, that every period of hopelessness that we experience, we always know that there will be restoration and redemption right around the corner. And that's particularly important for us to remember as we all experience a trial unlike anything other that we've experienced in living memory, and in some ways, because of its unique properties of disruption and ongoing isolation and quarantine, it's not just within our living memory, but one struggles to find really anything similar. Even the 1918 Spanish flu, as it was called, wasn't only in Spain, but that was the only place they were allowed to talk about it. You weren't allowed to talk about it in the United States or any country that was involved in World War One. Since Spain was neutral, they called it the Spanish flu because that's where you could report on it, which was far more devastating in terms of its mortality so far, and God willing that will continue to be the case. You didn't have this kind of disruption because it was thought at the time that it was better to get outside than it was to stay indoors. So you didn't experience actually what we're experiencing right now. So in some ways, it's actually unprecedented. What's particularly important for us to remember, even as we experience this kind of an unprecedented situation, an Eis Tzara, an ongoing period of crisis, is the idea of hopefulness and optimism, which is equally at the core of the Jewish tradition. It was only just a few weeks ago that we said, Om Dim Aleinu L'chaloseinu, they threaten us with destruction, V'Kadosh Baruch Hu Matzileinu Mi'adam, that we have total confidence ultimately in our survival and our perseverance as a people. So again, just to review, our preoccupation with the past is not so much the past for its own sake. There's obviously wonderful feelings associated with nostalgia, but the real point of the preoccupation with the past, which is normatively so overwhelming relative to preoccupation with the future in Judaism, is because a proper understanding, Zechor Yemos Olam, Binu Shnos Dor Vador, helps put us in touch with the values that best position us for the future. And so again, Yom HaShoah reminds us so much of the culture that was destroyed, but that it is our sacred responsibility to rebuild a culture of unmatched erudition and scholarship in Talmud Torah, also in the Chachmos, in all of the knowledge of the world that Jews in Western and Central European countries got to demonstrate that earned us such renown in the world, all of the Nobel Prize winners, etc., and even more importantly, the culture of Chesed that was so central to the Vague family, legacy, the culture of tzedakah, the culture of kindness and of compassion. Yom HaZikaron puts us in touch with the cherished values of gratitude and self-sacrifice that have always been part of the Jewish consciousness and Jewish psyche and Jewish ethos. And Yom HaAtzmaut puts us in touch with the notion of optimism and renewal, the ability to hold on to hope long beyond the point of irrationality. So hopefully, while we cherish the importance of historical perspective all year long and every single day of the year, there's no question that it takes on greater significance, starting with Pesach, when we transform ourselves back into slaves in Egypt, continuing with these critically important dates in recent Jewish history, Yom HaShoah, Yom HaZikaron, and Yom HaAtzmaut as well. They remind us of our timeless values. And in re-internalizing those values, they position ourselves, our current community, and the community that we know and trust will carry us forward into the future, the next generation. They put us in touch with those core values that are so central to our worldview. And so ironically, the best and most assured path towards the future is a proper understanding of the past and the values that the past calls to mind. Andy and Michelle, may your respective mothers, neshamos, have an aliyah. May their individual memories always sustain you and help direct your family's future. And more broadly speaking, may the memories that we all reflect on this time of year, Yom HaShoah, Yom HaZikaron, Yom HaAtzmaut, stand us in very good stead as a people as we look to position ourselves to be able to not only endure the current crisis, but to emerge from it a stronger community, a community that has a greater sense of appreciation for those timeless values for which the Jewish people always stood, for which we sacrificed, and ultimately which were bequeathed to us, and we will bequeath, God willing, to the next generation as well. Shavua Tov to everybody.
Thank you, Rabbi Friedman.